Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, who discusses his concern that President Obama will agree to major cuts in Social Security benefits in order to secure GOP votes to raise the debt ceiling. Ofer Nyman of the group Boycott From Within explains growing opposition to a new Israeli law that criminalizes support for the Palestinian-initiated and led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And Steve Rendell of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who assesses the political influence Rupert Murdoch has wielded in the United States as an expanding scandal in Britain threatens his media empire. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 20 years of failed negotiations with Israel, the Palestinian Authority plans to go before the United Nations in September to win statehood. The move to gain recognition for a Palestinian state is opposed by the United States and Israel and comes with significant political risks, notes the Christian Science Monitor. Palestinians cannot win actual legal recognition without an endorsement from the United Nations Security Council. The Obama administration has promised to veto any statehood proposal put forth by the Palestinian Authority, and the U.S. Congress could cut aid to the authority if it moves for full independence. Moreover, Israel has threatened unilateral action in case the Palestinians win independence. In addition, some Palestinian negotiators say a symbolic resolution by the UN General Assembly will not help end Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. In late June, an opinion poll found two-thirds of Palestinians support the UN bid for statehood. There is a strong expectation the Palestinian Authority will follow through after a UN vote to enforce Palestinian rule in the West Bank. A former Palestinian negotiator who is skeptical of the UN effort noted, despite protestations at the UN, Israel occupied Lebanon for two decades and is still occupying the Golan Heights in Syria. For the first time, UNICEF has delivered emergency humanitarian aid to camps inside Somalia controlled by al-Shabaab, the Islamic group tied to al-Qaeda that controls most of south and central Somalia. In recent months, a massive drought has struck Somalia, forcing over 1.5 million people to flee their villages in search of food and water. UN humanitarian officials have made an urgent call for aid as thousands of Somalis have crossed the border into Kenya and Ethiopia in search of relief. In 2010, al-Shabaab expelled all Western aid agencies from Somalia, declaring that they were anti-Muslim. Now, as the Islamic group welcomes back international humanitarian aid, some donor nations like Britain have refused to fund aid deliveries to camps controlled by al-Shabaab. Tens of thousands of Somalis have fled al-Shabaab territory, with many walking to relief camps near the capital Mogadishu, controlled by Somalia's weak interim government. With the influx of large numbers of Somalis, the camp in Dadaab, Kenya, is currently the largest refugee camp in the world. Capping off a major corporate lobbying blitz, the Federal Reserve Board approved a watered-down limit on fees for the use of debit cards at retail outlets like Walmart and Target. In late June, the Fed approved a 24-cent cap on debit swipe fees per transaction, double the fee of 7 or 12 cents the Fed initially proposed in December. The debt card limit, mandated by the Dodd-Frank bank reform law, prompted a well-funded lobbying campaign by the credit card industry to repeal the measure. When the bank lobby failed to change votes in Congress to repeal the fee limit on debit cards, it then applied intense pressure on the Fed for a weaker rule. This is the first regulation of swipe fees for debit cards. Previously, retailers and credit card companies directly negotiated the fees. The new Fed rule on swipe fees was immediately seen by Wall Street as favorable to credit card companies. On news of the Fed decision, stock prices for Visa and MasterCard jumped nearly 15%. Consumer groups and big retailers like Target and Home Depot blasted the Fed for caving into pressure from bank lobbyists. According to MarketWatch, each month, banks collect $1.3 billion in fees from debit cards used mainly in big-box retail stores. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
With dire warnings from economists about an imploding economy and threats by ratings agencies Moody's and Standard & Poor's to downgrade Washington's sterling credit rating, the White House and Congress have not yet negotiated a deal to raise the federal government's $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. With less than 2 weeks left before the August 2nd deadline, President Obama expressed hope that an agreement would be reached to raise the debt ceiling in time. While earlier negotiations to reach a so-called grand bargain to cut $4 trillion from the nation's debt failed, the president lauded the Senate's bipartisan Gang of Six for coming up with a new 11th-hour framework to cut $3.7 trillion from the federal budget over 10 years. The plan reportedly includes a reduction in tax rates through tax code reform and an immediate $500 billion in budget cuts, coming in part by imposing changes to the Social Security system's cost of living adjustment formula, known as chained CPI. Progressive activists have been greatly concerned by President Obama's willingness to offer major cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid during the current debt ceiling negotiations. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee recently delivered 200,000 petition signatures to Obama's Chicago campaign headquarters, pledging not to volunteer or donate to the president's campaign if he cuts Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security benefits. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthened Social Security Campaign, a coalition of 300 national and state organizations. He explains why he opposes the so-called $4 trillion grand bargain and the damage he believes will be caused by slashing the nation's social safety net programs.
First of all, there is no grand bargain if everybody's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is being cut dramatically, which is what's been proposed in part here. Backing up, we have a deficit. It's a long-run deficit. One day we have to get to. It is not the most important problem we face. There are many other problems we face. There are 14 million Americans who aren't working. There are two wars that haven't been paid for that are still going. There are huge tax cuts that have brought us to this point, along with the deregulation that helped bring us this economy. And there was also the passage of the Medicare Part D pharmaceutical benefits, which wasn't funded either during the Bush years. So what we have is basically a revenue problem. We have not been responsible in paying for the kinds of policies that particularly took place in the early part of the first decade of the millennium. What we're dealing with is a coordinated effort by some to delegitimize Social Security and Medicare and to define these as core issues with the federal debt. Social Security never has and never will borrow a penny, because by law it cannot have borrowing authority. It doesn't borrow. If Social Security did not have enough resources coming into it, then benefits by law would be reduced. So Social Security has absolutely no place in the deficit discussion. It's important to understand that Social Security is adequately financed for 25 years. Under the best estimates, the Congressional Budget Office, the Social Security actuaries, various people who make it, say it can pay all benefits out 25 years, and then after that, after about 2035, it's about 23 cents short on the dollar. And that can be addressed in a variety of ways. You could scrap the cap asking Americans to pay 6.2% on all their earnings. You could, for instance, to get a sense of the dimension of this problem, the projected shortfall in Social Security is the equivalent to roughly what it would cost to continue the Bush tax cuts for the richest 2% of Americans. This is not a difficult problem to address. It's a matter of political choice.
Eric Kingson, President Obama has put squarely on the table Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid as a bargaining chip. Obama says he'll cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid if the Republicans remove tax subsidies for private jet owners and big oil companies. What exactly do you feel is his motivation in terms of putting on the chopping block these very popular programs that are really a lifeline to some of the poorest, sickest, and most elderly people in the country who've put a lot of money into these programs in exchange for some minor concessions on the part of Republicans?
I don't know what his motivation is. I'm not going to try to guess that. What I do know is what the effect of doing this is. the cost of living adjustment and Social Security has been put on the table. The president had promised he would not cut benefits for current beneficiaries, but the current proposal that we hear has been on the table is to change the cost of living adjustment so that over time, everybody receives a smaller benefit. Someone who's 65 today, when they're 85, would get a cost of living adjustment that would be worth $1,000 less that year. So there's a decision made to pull some dollars out of pockets of hardworking people, people who've earned their benefits, and that contradicts the promises the president has made. It contradicts the promises of Democrats and Republicans, many Republicans, if we move forward with that. Also on the table, as part of the effort to show how balanced they are, we hear the idea of raising the Medicare retirement age to 67. Absolutely absurd. We should be talking about lowering the age of Medicare to cover older workers who are unable to maintain their employment in a very difficult economy, many of whom leave work because of health problems. We were going in the right direction with the Affordable Care Act, not perfect, but moving forward. This contradicts the act. It's horrible that this has been put forward as a negotiable item. I guess the motivation, I believe, is to show how reasonable we are, but frankly, with hostage takers, I don't think we should be exercising reason. It would be my hope that the president would go to the American public and say, look, here's what's at stake.
Eric, tell us what your group, Strengthen Social Security Campaign, a coalition of groups all over the country, what are they doing to ensure or to do their best to prevent the White House and Congress from axing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid?
What we're doing right now is we're focusing very heavily on the cost of living adjustment proposals that have been put on the table. We're also trying to send a message and encourage our friends in the White House to pivot and move away from putting Social Security on the chopping block, and particularly sending messages to all members, particularly the Republicans, that if they push cuts in Social Security, their constituents aren't going to be happy, not even the Republican constituents. When we deal with Social Security, don't deal with it behind closed doors. It has to be dealt with in the open because it's such a trust for the American people, and it always has been. Let's not have a sneak attack on Social Security.
That was Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security Campaign. Learn more about the coalition's work to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Israeli Knesset, or parliament, recently passed a controversial law that criminalizes support for the Palestinian-initiated and led Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement. The law, approved on July 11th, states that individuals or organizations advocating a boycott may be sued for compensation by any individual or institution claiming damage as a result. Evidence of actual damage will not be required. The measure also bars the government from doing business with companies that comply with boycotts. The call to resist Israeli occupation by nonviolent means through economic pressure was declared in 2005 and has been gaining momentum around the world. The BDS campaign takes its inspiration from the struggle of South Africans against apartheid, with the goal of persuading the Israeli government to comply with international law and universal principles of human rights. Israeli groups such as the Coalition of Women for Peace and Boycott From Within, which are the targets of the new law, say that the threat of lawsuits will not deter them from promoting BDS inside Israel. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ofer Nyman, a leader of the group Boycott From Within. He explains that opposition to the bill, now being challenged in court, came from both the left and right, and perhaps will have the opposite effect of what the Israeli government intended.
The law is already going to affect. So far, as far as I know, there have been no lawsuits filed. It feels as if most of the people who support this law are now somewhat on the defensive. I don't know if this means that the law will be repealed.
So opponents of this law say it's an attack on freedom of speech.
And also people saying, and I think they are correct in saying that the law will actually boost the BDS campaign and damage official Israel.
Ofer Nyman, explain how this sentiment against what Israel is doing is expressed within Israel And the other part of the question is, what connection do you have with Palestinians running the BDS campaign in the West Bank and also international supporters?
I think that more and more Israelis are becoming familiar with the term. One example would be Ehud Barak, the Minister of Defense. He recently gave an interview, and he spoke about BDS, using explicitly this term, as a threat to Israel. Of course, he's one of those stubborn people who will do nothing to change Israeli policies unless he's pressed hard against the wall. But he did mention BDS as a warning to the Israeli public at large. I think that most Israelis may still be unaware of the explicit term BDS. Again, one of the reasons is that the discourse in Israel has more to do with boycotting the settlement products. That's a different campaign. It's a very partial campaign, somewhat inadequate in my view. So most of the debating is around boycotting settlement products. Our group, which is called, the unofficial name is Boycott From Within. It's an Israeli support group for the Palestinian BDS call from 2005. And we try to spread that message. Of course, there's a strong connection between people in the group and the nonviolent Palestinian campaign against the wall.
So what are the consequences for those Israelis like yourself who continue to call for a boycott of Israel from within? Do you face arrest?
No, we don't face arrest. I mean, we may be arrested if we can't pay the fines eventually, if too many people sue us. But we're not getting arrested because it's only a tort. It's not a criminal offense. Too many people in Israel who are opposing the bill are speaking of Israel as a democracy and saying that democracy may be lost here. And I don't subscribe to this view. I think that if you look at it well, Israel is not really a democracy. Israel is closer to being an apartheid state if you consider the occupation. And it's an Israelocentric discourse that if they come for us, even if it's in a very minor way considering what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, then democracy is lost. I mean, democracy has been lost, if there was ever a significant form of democracy here, long ago. So, I mean, people in my group are trying to emphasize that it shouldn't be so much about us as privileged Israelis. It should be more, I mean, the discussion should be more about the Palestinians, about the occupation. And I don't think that Israel will become a totalitarian regime for people like me. One of the main reasons is that Jewish communities abroad are becoming concerned about it. It's bad for their business. It's bad for Israel advocacy. If Israel oppresses privileged Jewish citizens, that's why we've seen people like Eric Yoffe and Abe Foxman, prominent figures in the U.S. Jewish establishment, we've seen them speaking out, condemning this boycott law.
Israel's taken extreme steps this summer to keep international supporters of the Palestinian cause out of the region, like pressuring Greece to prevent the Gaza Freedom Flotilla from sailing, and pressuring airlines to prevent activists from flying to Tel Aviv and then going on to the West Bank. Do you think Israelis are feeling more isolated or maybe up against the wall than they have for the past several decades?
Well, many Israelis do speak of feeling somewhat isolated and the world doesn't understand us. But still, I think that now with a campaign which is inherently nonviolent, that many Israelis have to think well beyond that. You know, the average Israeli can speak as much as he or she wants about singling out and global isolation, but it's a very unique campaign, and I think that many Israelis are confused about it. And this confusion is good. We can do something with it, something constructive.
That was Ofer Naiman of the Israeli group Boycott From Within. For more information about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, visit our website at btlonline.org. Rupert Murdoch's international media empire, News Corp, is being shaken to its very foundations as a result of an ever-expanding scandal surrounding the conduct of reporters working for his British tabloid newspaper, News of the World. Reporters and editors at the paper have been involved in hacking into the phones of politicians, celebrities, the royal family, and crime victims, including 13-year-old schoolgirl Millie Dowler, who had been abducted and murdered. Murdoch employees are also charged with bribing police officials to get leads on news stories. As pressure on Murdoch and his son James ratcheted up, News of the World was closed, and many top officials of the company have resigned. British police have arrested News Corp CEO Rebecca Brooks, along with 9 other Murdoch employees. One of those under arrest is Andy Coulson, former News of the World editor and communications director to Conservative Party British Prime Minister David Cameron. 2 top Scotland Yard officials with ties to Murdoch have also resigned. U.S. media properties owned by Rupert Murdoch, a naturalized American citizen, include 27 television stations, 20th Century Fox, The Wall Street Journal, HarperCollins, The New York Post, and Fox News. With allegations that Murdoch reporters had attempted to hack the phones of 9/11 victims, some U.S. legislators have called for an FBI and Justice Department investigation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. He assesses the political influence Murdoch has wielded in the U.S. and the prospect that the scandal could cause News Corp to lose its broadcast licenses under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Well, I think when you look at the scandal and you look at the very clearly illegal things that are being alleged, like phone hacking, I think it's fair for American news consumers, American citizens, to ask, one, if there should be an investigation into News Corp, into Murdoch's holdings here. That's just for the things that are clearly illegal. But since we own the airwaves, which do not include cable, by the way, but we do own the broadcast airwaves, and Fox owns many, many broadcast licenses, we have a right to ask if somebody of Murdoch's character, we already knew some pretty negative things about his character before any of these things happened. But if some of these other allegations are true, we're allowed to have a debate over here about whether he should play the large role that he plays in our national media. And I think there's a larger story, too, and this is what John Nichols from The Nation, and he's been a regular commentator on the BBC recently, and I was talking to him last week, and he was pointing out that Murdoch played a significant role in getting George Bush into office, in getting Tony Blair into office in the UK, and getting John Howard into office in Australia, 3 of the chief point men in bringing us to war in Iraq. So these are some of the major questions, I think, that need to be addressed. We certainly have a right to ask for investigations, and we have a right to ask, depending on what those investigations find, we have a right to ask how large a role Murdoch and his organization should be able to play in our national debate.
As you laid out, Rupert Murdoch wields enormous influence in both Britain, Australia, and the United States with his news holdings in terms of influencing the political debate. We're all in favor of free speech. But does Rupert Murdoch and his media properties somehow violate the law or some kind of unwritten ethical code in terms of how he wields that influence, what he does with that influence?
Well, I think that as far as we know in the United States, we haven't got him breaking the law. We have him degrading journalism. We have him basically turning news organizations into propaganda outfits where lying and name-calling is a feature, not a bug. It's not something that happens. It's not an aberration. It's part of the organization. It's absolutely organic. Lying and name-calling are absolutely organic to most of Murdoch's holdings here. We do know that from some local Fox News stations, Fox Radio now has a lot of very vitriolic hosts on, and certainly Fox News Channel and the New York Post are name-calling organizations and really degrade journalism here.
With this scandal and the embarrassment and I think a lot of revulsion that people have about the kinds of activities that the Murdoch papers and media outlets were engaged in, could not this scandal be a catalyst to reimpose some regulations that would favor media diversity in this country and re-regulate so that we have more diverse views in our media system And we wouldn't have a situation where a media mogul like Murdoch wielded undue influence among politicians, whether it be here in the United States or in places like Australia and Britain.
Let me make this side issue, too. If you're a criminal organization, you cannot have a broadcast license in the United States. So if the Murdoch organization, News Corp or News International is the branch that's in the UK, if it is found culpable of crimes or if its major executives are found guilty of crimes, there could be a pretty good argument made to take away its broadcast licenses here. I have no faith that that will happen. Of course, General Electric has committed crimes. It's been convicted. And if people do start talking about maybe stripping Murdoch of certain FCC or certain media holdings here, the other media will quickly circle the wagons and say, yeah, it's just Murdoch. That's the problem. And so I don't think you'd see any across-the-board regulation because I think a lot of them would be pointing their fingers at Murdoch and at News Corp and saying, but they're the problem, so don't. Why are you coming after us? I think if media activists, media democracy activists, want to see something like real re-regulation of our media and a much fairer arrangement where a lot more people, in line with Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where a lot more people would have access to media, you'd have a lot more minority ownership of licenses and the like. If they want to see that, they're going to have to do a lot more work at getting a progressive administration and progressive legislators in. Because basically what we've seen over 30 years is we've seen Republicans or Democrats, people that were for deregulation, and certainly the Obama administration and the head of the FCC, Janikowski, have not shown that they are going to be protective of the people's voice in our national media. They seem to be more or less enablers of even greater consolidation and less regulation.
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. Read more about FAIR and the Murdoch scandal on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.